Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for a day today, someday, 22nd.
Wednesday
the 22nd. My co-chair has an announcement to make left over from Monday. Why don't we start with that? Senator Thompson?
We weren't here Monday. The best announcements are the ones made on the days we're not here, you know.
Exactly.
I just wanted to put on the record just a brief statement on House Bill 1503, which is the flu immunization bill that we were dealing with that sort of disappeared off the radar. Or Senate Bill 1503, I'm sorry. The point of that exercise is that we're rolling that subject forward into the next session of the legislature. There are some issues surrounding it that need more time. There's a committee working on that, and I'm hoping that they will bring us back more information for the next session. I'm talking to individual members of the committee. I know there's a consensus that this is an important public health issue. We will pursue it, and I'm hoping for a consensus bill that will move us forward in next session without any of the stakeholders beating up on each other. I know that's possible because we've done it in some other cases. It's just not the easiest way to go. So that bill will not be continued this session, but we will definitely have it back in 2013 or something similar.
We've got all the easy issues like mandatory flu vaccination, yeah. Pharmacy benefit managers, and
right.
Generic drug mandating.
Yeah, right. It's a good reason not to be here next session, right?
Should be a nice, quiet.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
I am going to open an informational meeting. The program takes shape for life. We have a lot of 20 minutes for this. We have six presenters, so that means you all need to say between 2 and 3 minutes, if that works. And let's start with Bryce Kennedy, Janet Anderson, Shirley Graham, please.
Well, Mr. Speaker, or Chair, Co-Chair.
Not for the next session.
Yeah, right. Getting ahead of myself. Well, Bryce is coming up. This is a topic that is of special interest to me as we move into this transformation stuff, because we have to find mechanisms to keep people healthy other than the doctor's office. We talk about wellness, we talk about all these other systems, but when it comes down to exactly what are we going to do, we immediately lapse back to a talk about physicians, nurses, and hospitals. And I was hoping that through this route we could get some discussion going of alternatives that we can use that might be less expensive and get us to that health maintenance level through an alternate route. And these are some of the operators.
Let's roll.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Bryce Kennedy. I've lived in Oregon for nearly 30 years, and today I'm proud to be a health coach with Take Shape for Life, assisting people in a complete and comprehensive health program. As just a brief matter of housekeeping, as a team, we're all coaches and we work together and support each other. All six of us have various ways which we're interfacing with our system and helping people. And so we've each kind of broken our testimony up into really kind of a cohesive whole. And so obviously it's your discretion of asking us questions. The second group of three, we have a physician or a doctor, a nurse practitioner, and one of our field leaders, nationwide leaders here, that will be in an excellent position to answer additional questions that you have of us. So I did submit the written testimony today. I'm going to just briefly share that previously I had been about 50 pounds overweight and was experiencing a lot of medical costs. And I did this nutritional program, worked with a coach, and there was 16 or 17 coaches or just clients that are in a room right now. And between us, we've lost over 800 pounds and kept the weight off. We've eliminated numerous medications. I have not missed a single day of work in 4 years due to any of my previous medical condition. That meant for me a dramatic change in life, and if I was a state employee or somebody else directly paying my health care costs, I could see those costs go down quite a bit. So the state has done quite a bit, taking positive steps to recognize the issue of being overweight and obese and the costs therein. So we just urge you to take additional action and change the focus of the Oregon Health Authority and all state agencies involved in health care and delivery of services to state employees and those covered by the OHP. Please move from merely disease treatment to one of health creation. Wellness programs that include personal coaching have saved a lot of money for many organizations. If you adopt an incentive model for state employees and expand wellness options for primary care providers, I'm sure many other Oregonians will see their lives improve too. And like me, their health care requirements will decrease and the subsequent savings to the state could be enormous. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Janet Anderson. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. I'm currently employed by the state. I own and manage rental properties in the Salem area, and I'm a personal health coach. My entire life, I struggled with weight. I tried many diets with very little success. In January of 2011, I was obese, in constant pain, and had very low energy. I felt getting in shape was hopeless. Today you see me 75 pounds lighter, at the same weight I was when I was 15 years old. I've shed 11 inches of fat from my waist and have maintained my healthy weight for over 4 months. As a state employee, I opted to take the health assessment and scored 97%. Now that's not bad for a 55-year-old postmenopausal woman on no medication. The habits of health taught in this program are quite similar to the Health Conversations, which is an animated cartoon tutorial state employees are currently encouraged to take as part of the health engagement model. Take Shape for Life takes the next step. This program provides one-on-one coaching, support, and encouragement so many of us need to actually implement these habits to create real health in our lives. I ask you to sanction and encourage citizens in our state to participate in this program that promotes and guides people to optimal health for the rest of their lives. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Shirley Graham, and I've lived in Portland, Oregon for about 35 years. I've worked for the state of Oregon and have been commuting to Salem for the past 20 years. I have followed the Take Shape for Life program to get healthier and to help gain control of my adult onset diabetes. In my 20 years as a state employee, I have seen a growing recognition of the importance of health for state workers and all Oregonians. The health engagement model introduced this year is a next step in bringing awareness and accountability for individual health. Now we need the tools. When I began the Take Shape for Life program, I was taking medications for high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and for diabetes. I was taking two kinds of oral diabetic medication and two kinds of insulin. And one of the, after losing 125 pounds on the program, I was able to stop taking insulin. Actually, the first insulin was gone after 3 weeks on the program. And one of the oral medications for diabetes, and reduce the dosage and type of cholesterol medication from Vitorin to a simvastatin. I'd like to note that the cost of the meal replacements on the Take Shape for Life program was less than the cost of one type of insulin, Lantus, alone. The cost to the state for Lantus is, for a month's supply for me, was about $348. Okay. The rest of my story is attached in an addendum, so you can hear more about my my journey and health impacts on my job and how that worked out. So I respectfully submit that you can read more of the story. The potential for getting healthcare costs under control is here. Better health means fewer medications, fewer doctor's visits, and fewer costly surgeries. There's a growing awareness of health benefits by making lifestyle changes. Many people find that the Weight Watchers program offered through PEB works in their lifestyle and is effective. Many do not find it effective or find that it does not fit either their lifestyle or does not meet their need for individual support and encouragement. We need effective options. My experience and coworker experience is that the Take Shape for Life program is an effective option. The meal replacements meet the need for portion control. Diabetics, that's essential. The end to hunger and to sugar addictions for many. The Habits of Health system with free personal coaching is a solid education for unlearning habits of disease and learning habits of health. I'm asking for recognition of programs with a wellness approach to prevent nutrition-related illnesses from even occurring. please make this a priority for state employees and expand access for Oregonians. Recognizing Take Shape for Life as a program to be used for weight loss or health gains would be beneficial to the state of Oregon. Thank you for hearing us today.
Grace, was your suggestion that we hold questions to the next panel or break now?
I believe that you will like the quality of the answers from the next three experts.
Okay, any immediate questions? Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for
being so concise. And we have
sharing your stories.
Lynn Frost, Jenny Coulter, and Jane Anderson, please. Please each start by introducing yourself.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Lynn-Ann Frost. I'm a certified pediatric nurse practitioner working as a primary care provider here in Oregon. I have over 20 years of healthcare experience. I'm not an employee, nor have I been a participant of the Take Shape for Life program, but rather
Could you pull the mic just a little closer? Thank you.
Rather a proponent of their educational and supportive system aimed at reversing the obesity epidemic. I'm here today to urge the legislature to acknowledge the gravity of the obesity epidemic on health to our residents, to recognize the multitude of chronic health care conditions that are directly linked to obesity, and to advocate for policies that will assist reversing this devastating epidemic. 4 out of every 10 children I see in the clinic are overweight or obese already. The vast majority of these children have extended family members that are overweight or obese as well. To use the analogy of the ship, the Titanic, their weight is much like the tip of the iceberg. Although this was the visible component that raised initial concern, it was what was lying underneath the surface of the water that ultimately caused devastating destruction and countless loss of lives. This is true of the multitude of chronic health care conditions that are occurring in the children I see. I currently have 8-year-old patients that are hypertensive and have heart disease already. By the time they hit their adolescent years, they're diabetics. This is the very first generation of children anticipated to live a shorter lifespan than that of their parents. In Oregon alone, we spend nearly $800 million annually on obesity-related illnesses. Nationally, that figure reaches $150 billion. Currently, as a primary care provider, I'm equipped at best with a rowboat in an attempt to steer this incredible vessel off of its deadly course. Although Senate Bill 931 earmarked $10 million annually to be used as preventative efforts, we need to make a further investment if we're going to successfully offset the incredible costs that are ultimately depleting our healthcare system of vital funds. Much like a carpenter, I need a variety of tools to effectively do my job to promote health in a person's life. Currently, my toolbox is empty when it comes to childhood obesity. In the respective time, I've attached my written testimony that gives specifics to the real obstacles that I face as a primary care provider. In closing, I urge you to begin to implement policies that support healthy living and a willingness for change. From supporting healthy eating and promoting physical activity to community design, collectively policy can be created that supports our population to begin leading healthy lives. This includes adopting program coverage for programs such as Take Shape for Life. I encourage you to learn more about this program and welcome you to contact me with any of your questions and concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Frost.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Coulter. In 2001, I relocated to Oregon to further my career in physical therapy. When I began practicing 18 years ago, I was able to restore people to health following acute illness. Today, this is the exception. Currently, I spend more time educating patients on how to live with limitations than real recovery. My purpose today is to urge you to consider a paradigm shift from treating illness to promoting the creation of a healthy lifestyle, and to consider how a program like Take Shape for Life can help you do this. Currently, my practice is with persons too ill to leave their home for treatments. The total cost of caring for these people, including medication, hospitalization, testing, procedures, and caregivers, is exorbitant. This is mainly due to the resultant medical and physical complications from chronic illnesses such as diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Nearly every year that I have practiced in Oregon, Oregon's Medicaid programs have had to reduce coverages for certain services. This is due in part to the increase in volume of people needing the care and the acuity of the care increasing for those that are already receiving treatment. Personally, I had a weight issue myself, and I have lost 50 pounds thus far on the Take Shape for Life program, and I'm now paying this forward as a health coach. I have included further examples in my testimony as well, but in closing, I would urge you to take additional action. As Co-Chair Thompson stated, the healthcare delivery system really needs to upgrade its focus from treating the symptom to managing the cause. Shift from merely treating disease to promoting and creating health. The medical demand caused by lifestyle illnesses is too high and is reducing the ability of some to receive needed care, especially at a time of budget shortfalls. But the fiscal savings from this paradigm shift could be even greater. Thank you for your time and attention to this significant issue.
Thank you.
In the interest of time, I will read my testimony. Those who know me will understand. Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlee, and members of the committee for the opportunity to present my testimony today. My name is Jane Anderson, and I am a certified health coach trainer, and field leader with Take Shape for Life. Since 1992, my family and I have lived in Oregon. In August of 2005, I began my journey from habits of disease towards habits of optimal health by losing 50 pounds. Since the new year of 2006, I have kept off the 50 pounds and have been living a healthy, vibrant lifestyle. In July of 2006, I began coaching, guiding, and supporting clients and health coaches in Oregon and across the United States towards a similar lifestyle of optimal health, raising awareness, educating, and supporting individuals along their journey from a degenerative symptoms caused by obesity and weight-related disease has become a strong feeling of obligation and passion. The Take Shape for Life system and free bio-network of support is the vehicle that can transport those who are hopeless and uninformed along the continuing long life path of a hope-filled physical wellness. While volunteering in the classroom and the PTA, 8 years of school board director, and even volunteering for hospice, my passion has been to create awareness and enact change. I've advocated for individuals who were unable to do it for themselves. As a wife and mother, I provide for and protect those who I care about most. Now, as a certified coach, I'm able to help anyone who wants to get healthy, from the obese to the athletic, the physically constrained to those who just want to feel better, even people who are taking a lot of medications, and now help people. I now help people regain their independence and thrive because of Take Shape for Life. The obesity epidemic plagues two-thirds of Americans and continues its destructive path. Medical expenses have soared, and the healthcare industry is limited to passive illness treatment and reacting to disease. Providers and state finance committees are forced to compromise their efforts. Rather than disease treatment, health providers should be focusing on regenerative health creation. In order to address the growing obstacles plaguing the healthcare industry, proactive measures need to be enacted. Because Take Shape for Life is a nutritional program clinically approved with medical backing that concentrates on creating health, it is a solution to the problem. Today we ask for your assistance. We've shared how Take Shape for Life has changed our lives and the lives of those we serve. Please fully consider how our comprehensive and complete system can help the state meet its goals for improving health outcomes while reducing health expenditures. We look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been hearing about these programs. You're not the first, so they're very much on our mind. Are there some questions? Representative Kenimer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you all coming to talk about this. And I guess, Dr. Frost, I was reading through your material, and you point out that four out of 10 of the children that you currently see are obese. That four out of the 10 children you currently see are obese. And then you have a remarkable statement. You say, currently my toolbox is empty when it comes to addressing the obesity topic. I wondered if you'd talk a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Because I think it would be a pretty pressing with 40% of the kids obese.
Correct. As we had stated, with two-thirds of our nation already being affected by this, the health issues related to this are tremendous. Historically, research has shown that primary care providers typically make the diagnosis 1 to 5% of the time, often with the belief that why make the diagnosis when indeed we have nothing to offer? We have no services. There is no coverage. Out-of-pocket expenses for working families often are so exorbitant that they can't just get a gym membership or they can't afford healthier eating habits. That leaves me as a primary care provider typically seeing these children, and truly it is 4 out of every 10 I see, typically for a 15-minute appointment where they're coming in with whatever health concern that has brought them to the clinic. And I'm expected to manage that as well as raise the fact that I'm concerned about their long-term health based on their weight, with truly nothing to come back on. It's not a covered diagnosis. So if I just diagnose somebody as overweight or obese, my appointment is not covered. I'm not reimbursed for that visit. So I can only wait until they are hypertensive and build a system that way because they have a secondary chronic health care concern that is a payable appointment for me. So in order for me to go above and beyond the call of duty for what they've presented for is out of the goodness and the kindness of my heart to affect their health long term and raise awareness and encourage them to start adopting a healthy life. That doesn't happen in my clinic. That can't happen in a 15-minute appointment. That has to be something that happens outside of the clinic and has to be something that is providing them the education, providing them the tools, and providing them the long-term support for them to adopt the necessary lifestyle modifications necessary.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Sort of a follow-up, and I thank you for that. Billable codes kind of determine outcomes, and also it's fascinating, you know, how what reliance we have on medication, even though it's not always complete. I mean, with my heart issue, it's interesting. I take anti-cholesterol medication, but it was kind of disappointing to hear that changing my food type of food wouldn't make much difference.
Correct.
Which was rather surprising and alarming, I might add.
Currently can't have a patient come back to see me for a 30-minute appointment to discuss nutrition, physical activity, and have it as a paid appointment. Yeah. But I can send them to the cardiologist when they're hypertensive, when they have high cholesterol, and that is something that we pay for. The majority of my patients are on OHP, and so it's coming directly out of tax dollars that we're covering these kids.
Mr. Chair, just to continue, one of the things that we haven't discussed is, for example, Take Shape for Life. What kind of money is involved in this? I hear you buy a special food. You must have other expenses.
Well, that was just it. I was going to ask if I could follow up to that, because what she is talking about as far as billable and what can't happen inside the clinic is exactly what we do provide. Excuse me, as health coaches, and our support is free, and many of our systems are free. We have some program materials that would, they are available for purchase, but again, we can coach people without the purchase of those materials, just with the systems and tools that we have in our own knowledge, education, and support as a guide, as well as you mentioned the food. Everyone has to eat. And so we really do think of this as cost neutral. We're not asking for any funding. We're asking for your leadership in taking part in educating, acknowledging Take Shape for Life as a program that is available to them. They need a choice. You have opened the doors to other programs within your benefit packages, et cetera. And so we're just asking for acknowledgement as this is another choice. And it's at no cost to you.
So coaches are volunteers.
We are servants.
I see. Yes. So it's somewhat analogous to the AA model, Alcoholics Anonymous, in that you're volunteers.
In some ways, if you're looking for how we are compensated, mm-hmm. if you're going down that road. I don't know if anybody else wants to.
Is that an okay road to go down? It is of interest, right?
Yeah, well, it is the question that comes up. Well, then how do you get paid?
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned in my statement, just so that you do know, for the record and for common knowledge, I've been volunteering ever since my first child started kindergarten. I've never been compensated for anything that I do. This program has changed my life. This program has changed the lives of many people that I know. I wouldn't stop talking about this whether I was paid for it or not.
But
how we are
paid.
Can
we go back to the big, is that how you're paid?
Okay.
Dr. Kennemer wants to join in the program.
Uh-huh.
Does he pay something? Does he pay by the month? Does he buy food? How does he get into the program?
We say for the program costs are free. We say for maximum results if you want ultimate benefits, depending on what your goal is. We may recommend that you, we do, we highly recommend Medifast. We don't hide it. That is a portion control meal replacement, and that's been acknowledged or explained a little bit in these appendices and with our clinical studies that we have provided in the record. Medifast has been around for 30 years, and it is a clinically based, proven to be safe, effective program, and Johns Hopkins has done the medical research studies on that, clinical studies. It was originally developed for the morbidly obese and diabetic, and it was a do-it-or-die situation, and it was only available by the prescription, the doctor's prescription. So then 10 years ago, and this is our upcoming 10-year anniversary with Take Share for Life, so again, you're not something new. This isn't a test pilot. We've been doing this for 10 years, and we've been impacting the lives of Americans all over. So I've lost my train of thought. See why I read my statements?
We do that all the time.
And I know that.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Representative Hoyle?
My question is, one, this happens to be an issue I have a lot of passion around. I mean, we have the first generation of children that will have a lower lifespan than the generation ahead of them, and obesity, lack of exercise, and lack of access to good foods are two of the major reasons. And when I go into my local elementary schools and I look at the kids there, they're not physically literate, just they don't have basic physical literacy, and there are a lot of children that are obese, and that is, it just sets them up for not only health care problems, but just, you know, many, many other issues. But about the food, my perspective is that it is essential and important, and we work with our local food bank, and we work with outreach in our local, you know, manufactured home parks, in teaching people how to utilize and cook good food, which is inexpensive, mm-hmm. that they have access to, that is whole foods, and again, things that they can purchase on their own, how to make your dollar go the furthest,
sure.
how to cook things, how to make nutritionally beneficial foods, but again, not buying prepackaged foods, because that's part of the problem that we have as a society, is that we're going and pulling things off the shelf that look cheap, but quite frankly are bad. And I guess I have a concern. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. I would love to give you a half an hour to talk to people about, you know, access to physical activity and better diet and things they can do. But I guess I'd want to know more about these foods. Are they prepackaged? Are they processed? I mean, that just seems like there's a... I'm not saying what you do is bad. I'm not making a value judgment, but it's not inherently... Mm-hmm. I have an issue with it.
If I'm out of order, can I speak to one of our... Patriots here.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're toward the end, but if you want to answer that question, come on up and introduce yourself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Again, my name is Bryce Kennedy. I'm also a health coach and regional director with our organization. I think in answering your question right there, it is very important that people learn a traditional eating approach. My wife is a full-time, part-time now dietitian, and she would have many consults, and people were coming back for years. And just a little bit of instruction is not enough. I had the knowledge. Why was I overweight? I needed a tool that I could develop the habit. We use the food tool. That is how the company compensates us. When people just shift their grocer for that period of time, then the company compensates us for coaching them. So there's really the out-of-pocket expense for me to do the program was within about $50 of what I was already spending on food. Many of my clients, it's far less than what they're already spending on food. So that does address that issue. We can provide some more details on that.
Like that.
But we use that as a tool to retrain the mind and body to eat every 2.5 to 3 hours. And like one of my clients who has food stamps, and they were saying the same thing about with food, they found a way to do it. Their whole family eats differently now. They approach food differently. Their habits changed. Their mind followed along. We gave them all these other tools. It didn't cost them anything, and I still work with them even though they're not my clients. I'm not required to, but they have access to our system for as long as they want.
But the bottom line description is this is a protein-sparing modified fast
diet. For the time that they are doing the weight loss phase only, but it is the weight loss phase is the shortest phase. And so we interface with physicians to be able to, where we're necessary, to get them to a healthy weight. And in that process, they will have retrained their mind and body to eat healthily. And then
I didn't make that up. It came from the article.
It's absolutely. Johns Hopkins University has endorsed it. They use it in their clinic. Villanova University teaches it with their nurses now.
Okay, great. I think we need to move on.
I was going to... Kenny Geyer and Thompson.
Okay, Thompson, I guess, first, and then Kenny Geyer, and then we'll move on.
Well, one of the, you know, we get out in the weeds with this program, but I think one of the points that needs to be made is that we have finally reached a point of understanding where we're including obesity as a quasi-disease state, and that's progress. Where we, I think, are still missing the boat, and it applies very much to what we're doing in healthcare transformation, is not recognizing that obesity is the multiplier on all of the other disease states.
Absolutely.
I spent most of my time in asthma, and it was really obvious that the patients that would be brought under the least expensive controls were the ones that weren't obese, or conversely, the obese asthma patients were a nightmare. And it's the same with diabetes and hypertension and situation after situation after situation. And I think we have to get to the point of understanding that obesity is an enormous cost driver as well as an exacerbator of all other conditions and start treating it as that. And this is one approach here. But ignoring it because fat people are all happy isn't necessarily the route we want to go if we're really talking about transforming healthcare.
That wasn't a question, I think.
That was a question, kind of. Why aren't we doing it?
Okay, you got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's not really a question either, but it can be short because it was very much along the lines of what you said. I want to thank you all for your testimony and acknowledge that I have a constituent here. It was very compelling, and I think you're great advocates for the program, but you could have also been in a hearing about the coordinated care organizations and the global budget because it's exactly what we're looking at. What's the evidence-based programs, and how do we get away from these billing codes and actually go to the measures that will really lead to good, you know, healthy outcomes, because we don't have that in our current system. So you would have been great advocates for that as well.
Well, we are looking forward to following up. We're all available, our field leader especially.
Great. And I was just going to say to Representative Hoyle's point, I agree, but I don't think it's necessarily an either or. We need to be doing those things. And unfortunately, many people live in communities where there's a food desert. They don't have access to healthy food. We've got a school system that's still not prioritizing PE, and so I agree that we need to keep working on that, but in terms of having as many tools in the toolbox as possible, I applaud you for working on this one.
Thank you. Thank you all
thank
very
you.
Much. Thank you. Close the informational hearing on Stay Safe for Life and open an informational hearing on issues inside the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Now, the reason that we've agreed to hold this hearing is because there were allegations that the board is systematically using its powers in an odd way to sanction chiropractors that do individual medical, independent medical examinations, IMEs. And we've looked at problems in chiropractic medicine and public policy since before the infamous Mahonia Hall events that changed the relationship between chiropractors and workman's compensation. And one of the issues that we're really trying to find out and that we really care about is to make sure there is the ability for there to be independent medical examinations. And so we're just exploring that. We've asked some folks to join us today. And if I can ask to begin, Dr. Friedlander, Dr. Burke, and Dr. Coley. Join us. That box us up donuts for us, Dr. Friedland. I wonder whether that box was donuts for the committee, which we can't have after the last presentation.
They're fat free, aren't they?
Fat free donuts, good.
They're air donuts.
Dr. Burke, are you kicking off? Following this panel, we'll have Dave McTee from the board and Dr. Coate, who's a member of the board. Is that Coate? Coate, who's a member of the board.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me to be here and present this testimony to you today. My name is Michael Burke.
Excuse me, Dr. Burke, hold on. I just do want to make one warning before we go. I've asked them in advance, please be very cautious about disclosing any medical information on any patients. I think there's a potential we'll be talking about individual cases, and if we are, just be extremely cautious, as I'm sure you would have been.
All of the confidential information concerning what I will speak about has been redacted, as well as the documents that I sent electronically to the committee members. My name is Michael Burke. I'm a chiropractor. I've been licensed in Oregon for 31 years. We're going to talk about, what I want to talk about today is malfeasance of duty on the part of the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners with respect to chiropractors who perform independent medical evaluations and medical record reviews. What I will cover is briefly a complaint that was brought against Dr. Tom Friedland, who's sitting to my right. I'm going to discuss how the board ignored evidence of clinical incompetency on the part of a doctor who instigated the complaints. Dr. Friedland will then speak about his Kafka-esque experience defending himself against the ludicrous complaints and charges brought against him by the board. And following Dr. Friedland, Dr. David Coral will give his perspective as a former chairperson of the board's peer review committee. He's a chiropractor who is in general practice and does not perform IMEs or file reviews. Briefly, by way of background, I've been licensed in Oregon since 1981. I'm a board certified chiropractic orthopedist. I've had a lot of different duties in my career as a chiropractor. I helped start a chiropractic managed care organization. I have sat for 3 years on the board's peer review committee. I was an associate faculty member at Western States Chiropractic College, later a clinical faculty member at the college where I instructed and supervised chiropractic students in physical rehabilitation, administered and evaluated OSCE examinations, which are clinical competency examinations, and I co-taught a class in evidence-based practice with Professor Richard Gillette. I also was a faculty member in the postgraduate division. I lectured to chiropractors all over the country on forensic chiropractic, which is what we're talking about today, independent medical evaluations and medical record reviews. That course was co-sponsored by the American Board of Forensic Practitioners. For the last 2 years of my tenure at Western States, I was an associate professor, and I supervised and trained interns in their last year at an outpatient clinic in Gresham. So in addition to all of that, I've performed independent medical evaluations, IMEs, and medical record reviews for the past 26 years. I want to briefly explain what an IME is. It's a type of consultation that's performed at the request of a third party, usually an insurance company, an attorney, or a self-insured employer, depending on the arena. Arenas can be, for example, personal injury, bodily injury, or workers' compensation. IMEs are usually requested to resolve problems with claims adjudication, and these problems might concern causation, compensability, the nature and location of the injury, medical necessity of treatment, disability, permanent impairment, and apportionment. In an IME, a detailed medical history is taken and a physical examination specific to the injured areas and related systems is performed. Medical records and diagnostic imaging studies are also reviewed. A medical record review is not the same as an IME. The patient is not examined. Only the medical records are reviewed, and if available, diagnostic imaging studies are also reviewed. In either case, a report is submitted to the party that requested the service. In an IME or a medical record review, for that matter, the examiner does not treat the patient. We do not give the patient advice. If there are treatment recommendations or recommendations for further diagnostic studies, they go in the report. The report is not withheld from the person who is examined. It's always available, and it has to be under HIPAA regulations. IMEs are performed by providers in many healthcare disciplines, but in most disciplines, there's little controversy about IMEs. In the chiropractic profession, IMEs are a highly contentious matter. Chiropractors who perform IMEs are vilified by their colleagues. The term insurance whore is often heard in candid discussions. Generally, chiropractors tend to believe that their work should not be questioned, especially by other chiropractors, and they tend to think of chiropractors who do IMEs and record reviews as traitors to the profession. If these doctors are being paid by insurance companies, the thinking goes, then certainly their opinions must have been determined by the source of the payment. I will emphatically state that that is not true. I've brought with me a few examples of this kind of attitude, and I hope you all have access to the PDF documents that I forwarded. There's a document that's called IME Abuse, A Plan for an End, and I've highlighted a few sentences in that magazine article. This is an article that appeared in a trade magazine, The American Chiropractor, which is mailed to over 50,000 chiropractors. And here is just some of the text that I highlighted. This is a doctor who is writing on how to deal with the IME problem, quote-unquote problem. He says, quote, in a perfect world, the IME doctor renders a second opinion that allows for necessary care of covered issues of injured patients. Now, the definition of necessary might be a lot different if you're the treating doctor or the examining doctor. But what he's saying is that an IME should allow care of the injured person. But that's not necessarily true because care of that injured person may not be medically necessary. That person may not even be injured. So already we have a difference of opinion here. He goes on to state, in the real world, an IME doctor rarely gives an opinion that is in the best interest of the patient. Further in the same paragraph, he says, the IME opinion usually sides with who writes the paycheck. I want to interject that when I do an IME or a record review, foremost in my mind is the benefit of the patient. I went into the chiropractic profession to help people, to provide a healing service to people. And I don't see my role as an independent consultant as any different than what I do when I care for my own patients. I'm restrained from giving them treatment or giving them advice, and certainly there are many times when I want to give them some advice, and all I can say is, I might have some recommendations and you really ought to read my report. So returning to this magazine article, the author recommends that if the treating doctor is unhappy with the IME's opinion, and I'm quoting again, inform your patient of his, her right to render a complaint against the doctor's license and direct him, her to the website of your state professional conduct board. Upon receipt of the complaint, the state is obligated to investigate and create a file on the offending doctor. Now, I want to direct your attention to another document which I submitted, which is titled Oregon DC Listserv. The Listserv is a Yahoo group that's open to all licensed chiropractors. It's a forum on which chiropractors can discuss various health-related topics. I have excerpted a few posts that are typical of the prejudiced and uninformed attitudes that chiropractors have concerning IMEs. Now, there are Listserv rules which restrain me from sharing the doctor's identities, so I've redacted all of that information. I'm just sharing the content of the discussions on there, and only just a few of them that are representative. If you look at the first post, which is dated August 22, 2011, the doctor is directing readers of the listserv to this American Chiropractor magazine article that I just mentioned, and he's encouraging chiropractors to file complaints against other chiropractors whose opinions they disagree with. Now, this post does not predate the complaints against Dr. Friedland, but the idea of complaining to the OBCE, the Board of Examiners, is not a recent one. There is another post, and it is not on the document that I sent, but I can provide it to you if you want. On November 19, 2009, a doctor posted the following, and I'm quoting now, please contact me privately off list or by phone if you have a case that was reviewed by Dr. Friedland. You may have your patients contact me directly if they so choose. Many thanks to the doctors that have already contacted me about this. It is a bigger problem than I imagined. Also, please forward this to other DCs not on this list. Three of the five spurious complaints filed against Dr. Friedland were from this chiropractor's patients. Furthermore, this doctor's records of those patients who filed the complaints are rife with evidence of his clinical incompetency and suggest that he is a threat to the public health. In pursuit of their investigation of Dr. Friedland, the board ignored this evidence. I'll discuss this more in a few minutes. I can talk faster if you like.
Or shorter.
I am trying to make it short, and I am about more than halfway through. There's another document that I sent you called OBCE Pressing Concern. This is an excerpt from a PDF posted on the website of the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards. It was also published on the OBCE's website, but it has since been removed. And what you're seeing is a part of a longer report written by Dr. Ann Goldine, who is currently the president of the Board of Examiners. At the time she wrote this, she was a liaison from the board to the FCLB. And when asked what the Oregon Board's most pressing concern is, she reported, quote, a growing concern that the current system of IME reviews is biased against patients in that the insurance companies and the review entities they contract with seem to gravitate to those reviewers who consistently cut off payment for care. She goes on to mention a case in which the examining doctor's findings allegedly did not support his conclusions, and this is apparently a reference to Dr. Friedland's case. Contrast this with a statement posted within the last week on the Oregon DC listserv from a board member whose identity I'm constrained from revealing that says, quote, complaints concerning IMEs and paper reviews account for just 3% of total complaints, 28 total, since 2001, unquote. If there are so few complaints occupying the board's attention, then why does the board consider this to be the most pressing concern? I want to move on now to a document titled Dr. X Complaint. This is a summary portion, the summary portion of the complaint I filed with the OBCE concerning the records of the chiropractor who instigated the complaints against Dr. Friedland. The complaint, I believe, is currently being investigated by the board's peer review committee, so I've redacted the name of the doctor, the name of the patients, and all the other identifying information. I didn't file this complaint because I'm Dr. Friedland's friend or because I'm his former office partner. I filed the complaint because the records indicate to me that this doctor is not competent to practice chiropractic and may well be a danger to the public. I also filed the complaint because I feel strongly that the members of the board should themselves have investigated this doctor. It show, and I'm quoting Oregon administrative rules here. It shall be the duty of every licensee to notify the board's administrative office or any member of this board of any violation of the act or of these rules in order that the board may take appropriate investigative and corrective or disciplinary action. I also want to quote Oregon revised statute 162.415, official misconduct in the first degree, section 1 sub A. The public servant knowingly fails to perform a duty imposed upon the public servant by law or one clearly inherent in the nature of the office. I believe the board violated its own rule in this case, and I believe they did so because they were blinded by their prejudice against doctors who perform independent medical evaluations and record reviews.
Dr. Burke, will you wrap it up, please?
I have wrapped it up. Thank you.
You did good. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for listening to me.
Dr. Friedman?
Chairman Greenlick, I acknowledge Chairman Thompson, but he stepped away from the dais. Members of the committee, I thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Thomas Friedland. I'm a chiropractor practicing in Tigard, Oregon. In addition to treating patients, I perform independent medical examinations and records reviews. Nearly a year and a half ago, the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners voted to issue me a letter of reprimand claiming the conclusions in my reports were not supported by my examination findings. The material being handed to you includes a copy of my CV, a copy of the cases in question with patient information redacted, as well as material related to this and definitions. My testimony is also the last portion of that document. The board had received a series of complaints from patients I had examined during IMEs. A husband and wife were upset I had been asked to review the treating doctor's records. A woman was upset that it took too long to perform a standard examination and that the basic procedures hurt her. Another patient complained I yawned when I greeted her and that I didn't look at her when I took her history. A fifth patient simply said I was biased against her. As anyone who performs IMEs, such complaints are uncommon, or not uncommon. They're usually dismissed since there's no statutory violation. For some reason, these cases were handled differently. There is evidence the complaints were instigated by a disgruntled doctor. While the board can choose how to investigate a complaint, these were handled in quite an unusual manner. Rather than review the cases themselves or send them to the peer review committee, they sent the files to an outside chiropractor for review, saying they did so because I was on the peer review committee. The reason why the board could not review the case has never been explained. Complaints against board members are often referred to the peer review committee or to the board itself. The involved doctor is typically recused. The board received this outside report and voted to issue a letter of reprimand for allegations quite different than anything described in the original complaints. The board has a policy to allow doctors to speak to charges before discipline is considered. I was never given this opportunity. In another case recently, involving a doctor who had completed a records review, the board voted to discipline him without an interview. Later, they rescinded that vote, saying they violated their own policy. This would suggest the board acted deliberately in denying me an opportunity to discuss my case. 3 weeks after voting to discipline me, the board posted a statement on their website and the website of the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards, as Dr. Burke pointed out, that the most pressing problem in Oregon was the current IME system was biased against patients. It went on to say that the board had a current case against a chiropractor they believed had not supported his conclusions by his examination. Mine was the only case pending. In reviewing the minutes of prior board meetings, there's no mention of such a concern regarding IMEs. Just last week, in reference to today's hearing, there was an email posted that recapped the disciplinary action in Oregon against IMEs amounting to only 3%. That would appear to be a contradiction to the earlier statement. However, the statement on the Federation of Chiropractic License Board is still present, and the information from the Oregon Board has been updated recently. My letter of reprimand was received 10 weeks after the vote, week after minutes for the meeting had been publicly posted on the board's website, indicating I had been so sanctioned. The ledger alleged my examinations were inadequate because I had not mentioned muscle tone, and said this was a required component of the clinical justification rule. The rule doesn't make such a requirement. My reports were quite explicit and demonstrated a full evaluation of the patient's injuries. To say they did not exceed, let alone meet the criteria of the administrative rule, would be a break from reality. The letter said I had not commented on imaging studies on one patient, yet my report had a section devoted to the topic. They said I should have followed up on the treating doctor's diagnosis of a space-occupying lesion and a compression fracture. This is absurd. There was no evidence on my examination, and there was nothing within the treating doctor's records that would support these conclusions. The diagnosis of a space-occupying lesion, a tumor, was made by the same chiropractor on three different patients that filed complaints. These diagnoses were why I questioned the credibility of the chiropractor's records, yet I was supposed to further investigate these conditions. Simply put, the treating chiropractor's records were not to be believed. The board must have reviewed these records, yet they relied on them to find fault with my reports and took no action against the treating doctor. Later, they would say they would question the other doctor's records only if they received a complaint. My exam on another patient who complained to the board showed motion was limited. The board said I needed to explain why she was limited. In my report, immediately after the measurement, I described how she had full range of motion immediately after the measurement, indicating that her range of motion exam was not valid. Other tests that were performed during the course of the exam suggested that she was magnifying her symptoms, and her history suggested an injury some weeks after the accident in question. The board did not even consider this possibility. Still another patient said she remembered her motion was limited during my exam. It was not. The board contended I should have included her perception of limited motion in my report, a claim made weeks after the examination, and then only to the board in her complaint. That's ludicrous. The board said I violated the informed consent rule, yet every report submitted referenced a signed informed consent that I had obtained from the patient. I was also faulted for not releasing records, but there'd never been a request for records. There was no substance to the allegations in the letter. The only thing I could agree to that was in the letter was that I had seen these patients. The OBCE suggested mediation and then changed their mind and invited me to their March 2011 board meeting, 6 months after the original vote. Despite my repeated requests for them to explain their allegations, they had insisted on asking questions such as, what journals did I read? And is there a conflict of interest in performing IMEs and treating patients? The board was stymied by the term objective findings. My use of the term was consistent with the definition used in workers' compensation cases per Oregon Revised Statute 656.005, subparagraph 19. With no resolution, the matter was advanced to a hearing before an administrative law judge, which could not be scheduled until August 2011. On the eve of discovery, the board proposed an agreement of voluntary compliance, an AVC, for no real particular reason. It can be speculated that they realized they didn't have a case. I reluctantly agreed to this non-disciplinary but public resolution, as it would stop the emotional and financial drain of defending this case. However, the AVC has been interpreted by some of my former and potential clients as discipline since it's labeled as a board action. This entire event could have been avoided if the board had acted appropriately. From the start, they treated me differently. They violated their own rules by voting for a disciplinary action without providing an opportunity for explanation. They publicly posted a proposed letter of reprimand that they knew or should have known was untrue. And they pursued this case with a complete lack of evidence. This suggests that they allowed their emotion or bias to cloud their objectivity. The members of the board have misused their position of responsibility. It is my hope that your review of this matter will help correct deficiencies in the disciplinary process to prevent this type of abuse from occurring in the future. One suggestion that Dr. Burke was going to bring up was that a solution for this potential problem was to include doctors that do forensic work within their peer review committee or on the board itself. I would agree with this proposal. And to that end, in light of the evidence that I've discussed, it would not be unreasonable for the board to expunge my record and reappoint me to the peer review committee. I appreciate your time you've devoted to this topic. I thank you for inviting my comments. And if you have questions, we'll be happy to answer them.
Dr. Friedler, how much have you spent on lawyers defending this so far?
I'm sorry?
How much have you spent on lawyers defending this so far?
Well, between there was a secondary issue in this, but in total costs, it was $46,000.
Thank you.
Hi. I am David Coral, co-chair.
Former
co-chair Greenlick and or co-chair Greenlick and co-chair Thompson and the rest of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. I am not an IME doctor. I am just a regular chiropractor in the field. In 2005, the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners appointed me to the peer review committee. The peer review committee reviews complaints against doctors on cases sent to them by the board itself, and in a sense, they're the investigative arm. Shortly afterwards, I was nominated to chair, and I spent most of my time on the peer review committee as the chair for the peer review. Once I was nominated to chair, the executive director informed me that the protocol for on cases that would come before us, if we ever had a reason to believe that the doctor in front of us would potentially face disciplinary action, we had to bring them in for an interview to grant them due process. If we didn't do so, that would compromise the case later on because they weren't afforded an opportunity to represent themselves. In the 7 years since that time, 2005 to 2002 now, I've only seen that protocol violated twice, and both times it was with IME doctors, Dr. Friedland being one of them and another doctor in another case. Those doctors were publicly sanctioned in the sense of a notice of public discipline was posted prior to them being interviewed. Those are the only two cases in the dozens that the board got that they did act on where they didn't grant an interview prior to making their disciplinary decision. The current system we have in place now, I believe, does not just concern with the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners. I think it's the way the law is written, is flawed in two aspects. One is it allows a board to publish proposed disciplinary action before the case is fully adjudicated. They can publish that this doctor is going to be reprimanded in this sort of fashion prior to the hearing, prior to the end of the case. And it is possible that that doctor's case could be resolved without any disciplinary action, yet the publication has already happened. And this is especially harmful for IME doctors because their reputation is now out, they have this mark on their record, so to speak, out in the field. And with IME doctors, as opposed to a field doctor like myself, that will stop their livelihood. The companies who employ them will not send them any more business until this matter is resolved, and that's part of the damages that were caused to Dr. Friedland. The other aspect of the system that's flawed, in my opinion, is that the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners has no check and balance. They don't answer to anyone directly other than the governor's office, and for a matter to go into the governor's office, it would have to be quite extreme. Other matters than that, they don't answer to anybody. As such, any actions they initiate against a field doctor don't really cost them much, as financially or work-wise. The other side of the coin, however, as Dr. Friedland pointed out recently, is the financial impact on a field doctor can be significant, even if the charges are unfounded. The cost of going to appealing and to actually resolve a case in front of a secondary committee like a court would be quite extensive, and that money has to come from the doctor just to defend himself, which is expected in cases of discipline, but it's absurd if the discipline was unfounded in the first place, because those monies are not reimbursed. And this is especially harmful for IME doctors because while they're going through this adjudication process, while they're getting their case resolved, their livelihood has been, from that source of revenue, has been decreased significantly. So they're getting kind of hammered from two different directions. I want to give you my perspective from a non-IME point of view and my experience on the board. Other than these two cases, the board has always followed protocols. Just these two in the last 7 years that I have knowledge of, where they didn't follow the protocol, and it just happens to be IME doctors. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions in this panel? Thank you very much.
Thanks Thank you
coming.
Very much for your Thank time.
We have a lot of homework if we're going to have to read this.
A little bit of reading.
Mm-hmm. And I call Dave McTeague and and Dr. Cote, please. Dave, you want to kick it off?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk before you today. My name is Dave McTeague, Executive Director, Board of Chiropractic Examiners. I've been on this job almost 16 years. With me is Dr. Daniel Cote, chiropractic physician from Silverton, who serves as the Vice Chair of the Board. I've got some testimony that we're handing out to you. Just want to be clear, the confidentiality issues that concern us don't just cover patient records, they cover identity of complainants, any cases, complaints that have been filed that are currently under review by the board. If a complaint is closed, we're not even supposed to acknowledge the existence of it pertaining to any specific doctors. So the legislature has given us some pretty firm rules on the whole issue of confidentiality.
But if the case is closed, things come off your website then?
I'm talking about cases where the board has considered a complaint and the result of that consideration is case closed or no action, insufficient evidence, no statutory violation, where basically the board closes the complaint with no formal board action.
But if you're taking any kind of action,
if the board votes to issue a notice of proposed disciplinary action, that is a public document. And
so is that because I think we've got a couple of things going on. Mm-hmm. Clearly, this is an emotional issue. And
yeah, you have no idea.
I can guess. But both in that independent medical examiners, which not just with chiropractic, but throughout, you know, that's tough. It's like working for internal affairs, you know, if you're a police officer. And then the other piece is that, you know, certain people, each side thinks they're right, but I think what we're supposed to do here today is understand what the process is. Sure. And whether it was followed. So is it not just for IMEs, but for everybody that you put out notice of proposed?
Correct.
So that is not just with one.
Right. You can go on
one
our website.
Particular case. So this, because what it sounds like is being, and the issue that we would have to discuss. Sorry, can I follow up?
Please.
Yeah. Is there a process? Is that process appropriate?
Yeah.
Was that process followed, or is there some kind of, is this only followed for certain people in some kind of vindictive way? In which case that,
right.
But so I just really want to know about the process. What was it? Was it followed, and is it consistent?
Yes, and different complaints raise different kinds of issues in terms of how to conduct your inquiry, but absolutely the process is appropriate. In some cases, the board says, this complaint we want to send to the board's peer review committee for further review by another panel of doctors. Usually the respondent doctor is called in for an interview, and then the peer review committee conducts the interview, writes a report, and that goes back to the board. In other cases, the board might say, this particular case needs some other kind of review. We want to have a chiropractic consultant review the case. You know, in some cases, when if it's an X-ray case, we consult with a chiropractic radiologist to bring in that kind of professional expertise. So, you know, we have latitude in our process to go outside and get extra help or expertise to help the board in its decision-making process. That all information comes back to the Board of Chiropractic. They deliberate, and then they make a decision on how to proceed from there.
Where I was getting with the question is you were talking about what you can talk about and what you can't talk about. And
right.
In Dr. Friedland's case, he said there was something put on your website with an intent to complain to. It was an action. And then some other action was taken. So was that original one modified on your website?
I'm not sure what they're referring to exactly. There was a doctor, one of our board members went to a national conference and wrote a report, and they were referring to that.
Well, wait a minute. Let me see if I can help you understand. Dr. Friedland testified that you had on your website a specific notice of intent to
propose disciplinary action.
That's
proposed
correct. The disciplinary notice action. Proposed disciplinary action.
And after something happened at that point, was that notice modified or was that kept on the website in its original form?
Once we enter into the voluntary compliance.
Well, I don't remember that the board amended the notice of proposed disciplinary action. I don't think they did. And ultimately, the board agreed and the licensee agreed to an agreement of voluntary cooperation. And that is a public document, and that is available on the board's licensee lookup currently.
That's what I was
saying. Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah. That's
you know, and in terms of the continuing on the process, which I address in our written testimony, you know, there is a contested case process. There's an elaborate due process, and these issues that are being litigated and attempted to be litigated in front of you today typically are litigated in front of an impartial administrative law judge. You know, and the respondents often argue a variety of points of view. You know, this evidence says this, and the board is wrong on this, and this interpretation is incorrect. And then it's argued back and forth, and there's cross-examination, and the administrative law judge renders an opinion. The licensee has the option to have an attorney or not have an attorney. There are many, many administrative proceedings, contested case hearings that happen where people represent themselves. That's an option. So that is the appropriate forum to address these kinds of issues and come to a result. If the board is so completely off base on their allegations and their findings, you know, then the administrative law judge says that, then the administrative law judge could say to the board, I recommend you dismiss the case. And that is an option for the licensee to pursue the process all the way to the end. I've given you a list of the contested case rights and procedures, which outlines in some detail their rights at hearing. Typically, most of our cases are resolved through a process of negotiation. The board issues a notice of proposed disciplinary action. Either we have a discussion. I have a discussion with the licensee. If the licensee is represented by legal counsel, the board's AA assistant attorney general generally conducts those negotiations or those settlement discussions. The issue comes back to the board. Will you accept this resolution to the issue? And that's how 95% of our cases are resolved, as is the case with most health professional licensing boards.
Cody, you want
to? Yeah, I had a few comments. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to speak today. First of all, the process sometimes takes a little long because we do meet only every 2 months. Well, and
please
so
introduce yourself.
Oh, Dr. Daniel Cote, I'm sorry, since they introduced me earlier. Chiropractic practice in Silverton, and I'm the vice president of the Board of Chiropractic Examiner currently. So sometimes the procedures do take a little bit of a long time because we do meet only every 2 months. So we're all basically volunteered position, and so we gladly don't have enough work to meet more than every 2 months. So most of the cases sometimes will go on over a multitude of meetings depending on the negotiations, and then the executive director has to come back to us, say, this is the proposed that the party would like to
see resolve this. And sometimes we have to wait a month, month and a half just to meet on this subject. Then I wanted to talk about, Dr. Burke brought up articles about IME from journals, from the ACA and so on. And really this is all very irrelevant to the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiner. We didn't write these articles. I actually have never read the articles that he's talking about. And I can assure you that there is no bias from myself as a member and that I have perceived from the other members of the board, two of which are public members. So really, they don't have any bias against IMEs or any other types of provider since they're public members and not physicians themselves. So also, you have to remember that the Board of Chiropractic Examiner does not deal with difference of opinions, which is what most of the IME complaints are about. And that's why most of them have been dismissed for no statutory violation or insufficient evidence. What we deal with is appropriate clinical justification in regard to a conclusion of any examination, whether it's independent or not. We hold every doctor to the same standards and minimal standards of care in the case of doctors that actually treat the patients. Also, Dr. Coral at the end there stated the financial impact on a licensee on the board action. You know, as far as I'm concerned, my malpractice insurance actually covers me in case of board action. I don't believe I have a policy that's much different than any other chiropractor in Oregon. And so these should be instances that are covered by your malpractice insurance, just like if a patient claims that you have done something wrong in a civil court law. Also, I think this might be a good opportunity to just make a statement of why not create a process that would ensure independence in the independent medical examiner. You mentioned that term earlier, Representative Greenlick, and that's something that just occurred to me many times over the years, is that inherently the system is giving an appearance of bias, because a certain doctor might be hired very frequently, whether it is just because that's what he does for a living, or it just gives an appearance of non-independence because he's hired by the same company. Mediators in this state, if you ask for mediation, they will pull three names out of a pool of qualified mediator, and then each party is allowed to strike one of the names at their choice, and then it's random. It's truly independent. There's no dependency or appearance of dependency on the outcome of the mediation or, in this case, of our examination.
But I've watched the profession for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and there are some of your physicians that treat as a standard five times a week for a week,
yeah.
four times a week for a week, three times a week, whatever the diagnosis that goes on. The notion is that that person is not independent either. That person is making money off that case.
Yeah.
So the notion that the insurance company is somehow biased because they want to say, well, wait a minute, should that person keep treating somehow they're biased, but the physician who's getting paid by the visit through the insurance company is not biased, is that?
Oh, no, that is not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying that in order to create a system that would have a better appearance of non-bias. I'm not even saying that IMEs are biased at all. I think that most IMEs, if not all of them, are very qualified and honest and truly independent. But sometimes we get complaints made to us because of the appearance of non-independence, and that's what I'm saying. And we have, if you look in our statistics, we have a lot more actions on doctors that do over-treatment than we do on independent medical examiners. Okay, and we take that subject very seriously, actually, and we're very, I personally, as a member, I'm very concerned with some of the tendencies out there of over-treatment and over-utilization and over-billing. So,
I had a couple of questions. So, we heard from the previous testimony there were concerns about the board not being completely representative, and I've worked with many of the licensing boards, thanks to my good co-chair. Can you tell me what is the makeup of your board? Like, who's on your board and who do they represent?
The board is five chiropractic physicians and two public members. There's a doctor from Medford, Astoria, Silverton, yeah. And what am I missing here?
And two from Portland?
Portland.
And you said and two members?
Two public members.
So yeah. Consumers.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Okay, and then what do you ever have people who are doctors that are IMEs on your board?
Yeah.
But is it just a matter of chance?
Our board president has done IMEs, Dr. Goldine from Astoria. In the past, we had Dr. Simpson on the board of chiropractic, and he was known for having done a number of IMEs.
Have you had specifically anyone who this is their main form of business, or is it common? I'm not sure.
That many chiropractic physicians out there whose income is derived primarily from the conduct of IMEs. If that were the case, it would be a very small handful.
But a lot of chiropractors do a little bit of work?
We don't actually have formal statistics on this. What we see is the occasional complaint or whatever in an IME report that may or may not be in a file, and we see some folks doing those more frequently than others. There's a chiropractors out there who do just a smattering of them. There's a very small number that do a lot of them.
So, and then I just had two quick other questions because I have to run to another hearing. But
ask your question and leave.
Yeah.
I want to hear the answer. Okay.
So it's just going back to process. There's two questions I have. One is about the exam by the outside. The consultant that normally this goes to the board, and that this particular case was sent to an outside consultant, and that's not normal process, and that's not normal procedure, which is, again, what we're here to discuss. And then the second is about the ALJ. Like, if you don't like what the board said, then you get to go to an ALJ. Did your board, and this clearly happened in this case, yeah. Did your board take the recommendation of that ALJ?
Well, it didn't go to hearing.
It didn't.
Right. This case was resolved with an agreement of voluntary cooperation. The agreement is non-disciplinary. It is a board action. It was approved by the board after a notice of proposed discipline. That's how some of our cases are resolved.
Okay.
So this didn't go to hearing. What I'm saying is it could have gone to hearing. I mean, for this amount of unhappiness over the result of a case, the licensee had the opportunity to go through the process, and I would argue probably should have, since they're not happy with the result. This would have completed the circle.
It's not certain to say he's unhappy with the result. I think he's unhappy with the process.
But he also did not take advantage of the process that was given to him. He entered into a voluntary compliance agreement.
His testimony that he couldn't get a hearing before you is not correct? He was offered a hearing to explain his thing, is that?
Yeah, he had an appearance
after you filed a notice of disciplinary hearing. His testimony as I heard it, and Dave and I had conversation on this before in this case, was that he asked to be not examined by some independent person who just looked at his records, but to have a hearing, to have a meeting where he would be able to defend himself months before you finally agreed to meet with him. Is that wrong?
There have been some statements today that aren't entirely correct about the board's policy for bringing doctors in for an in-person meeting with the board. The board kind of does that
on
an as-needed basis at various points in inquire that they're conducting. And a lot of complaints that we receive, the board reviews the information in the investigator's report and they make a determination. They don't invite all the licensees in for a personal visit on each and every case. Most boards don't.
How common is it where you actually issue a disciplinary intent where the chiropractor has not had a chance to either appear before an investigator or board members or anybody? Is that common?
I mean, the investigator has interviewed the doctor and written a report and given a written report to the board.
But Dr. Friedland testifies that he was not interviewed by anybody. I mean, should we get him back up and ask him about that? That in your process, until the very end, until the mediation meeting, he was not able to get anybody to talk to him.
We receive a complaint. We summarize the complaint. We send it to the respondent. We get a written response. The written response, all the patient file information, and the complaint is provided to the board.
But I asked you a very simple question.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're looking at what we need to do statutorily to deal with this, and this is an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Dr. Friedland say that he tried to get somebody to listen to him in addition to, I mean, his story is you sent him a complaint. He answered the items on that complaint. You issued a letter of reprimand about things entirely not on the complaint. Nowhere in that process was he able to get an interview with somebody to talk about his case. Now, under the assumption that that's true, and if not, we'll call him back up and ask him. My question is how frequently is that you're prepared to issue a letter of reprimand
right,
without giving the person the opportunity to defend themselves in person? Is that unusual? Is it regular?
The doctor gets a chance to respond. Usually that response is in writing to the board.
Let me try one more time, because I may not be communicating well.
No.
My question is a very simple question. How often is it, how frequent is it, that you issue a letter of reprimand without giving the person the opportunity to defend themselves in person before either an investigator or members of the board? Is that a common practice on your part?
A notice,
because if so, we need a statute about it.
A notice of proposed disciplinary action is not the actual issuance of anything. It's the issuance of a set of charges and allegations subject to the contested case hearing process.
Okay, let me try my question again. It'll be the same question.
You're saying prior to the board's notice of proposed disciplinary action.
How frequent is it that you go into disciplinary action without giving the person a chance to defend themselves? That's the question, in person. Is it a regular procedure? You say, oh, no, we never invite them in. They answer always in writing. Is it, oh, yeah, they usually have an opportunity to be interviewed to defend themselves? Or it's an empirical question, Dave. Is it frequent or is it unusual? My sense is it's unusual. My sense is, folks, before most boards, when they're charged with something, they get a chance to defend themselves. Is that not usual for the chiropractic board? You just go willy-nilly without talking to these people? Or is this an unusual circumstance?
Well, I wouldn't call it willy-nilly. The board reviews the entire file and makes a decision. They may not call the doctor in for a personal interview. That's not the standard practice.
Yep.
That's the question. It is not your standard practice. So out of the last 10 cases, two of the people were called in. Out of the last 10 cases, six of the people were called in. Out of the last 10 cases, 10 of the people were called in. How frequently do your board members get a chance to defend themselves in person before either your investigator or other members of the board? Is that an unusual thing for him to have asked for?
It's somewhat unusual, yes.
Why don't you try?
Okay. They all get an opportunity to respond to the complaints in writing. And we traditionally go by the writing response to the complaint. And then we read through all these packets and the patient files and so on. And then from there, we make an initial decision. And that's when we bring in a proposed disciplinary action. After that, there's a whole other process then where there is opportunity to meet with us, to meet with the peer review committee, to meet with, and all the way to the administrative law judge.
Have you read the case record on this one?
I'm sorry?
Have you read the case record on this one?
I have, yeah.
I mean, I'm prepared to put a statute in next time that requires you to give due process to your licensees, including the opportunity to defend themselves in person. Now, would that end up being a hardship for you because it's something you never do? Or would that be, oh, well, 9 times out of 10 we do it anyway, we just didn't do it in this case for X or Y or Z reasons? We're trying to figure out what we want to do to to help your board serve its members better. That's why we're here today. We're not here. They're trying to slow me down. Good. Representative Kenemer.
Mr. Chair,
get me off the end of this limb.
No, I think you're asking a good question. I think if I understand your question, I think it's a really good one, and that is, does a chiropractor have an opportunity to defend themselves before an accusation becomes public? Is that not what you were trying to ask?
That's the question.
Yeah.
And that's the question, I guess, I would ask.
I would say they do in their written response to the...
I see. So, but it could be limited to just a written response, not necessarily an interview.
Mm-hmm. That's your answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree with you, Dr. Greenlick. I think this needs a little process. Excuse me.
Yeah, I was going to try another version of your same question and go back to what Dr. Correll said as former chair of the board's peer review committee starting in 2005, and that in all of that time, my understanding of what the stated process was, and then you raised some question about that, so I want to get your clarification about what your actual process is. What I understand him to say was that the process was to, in fact, give the person an opportunity for a personal interview, and that in all of that time, he only saw two cases in which the people were not granted interviews, and in those two cases, they happened to be IMEs. I don't know if I'm capturing that correctly. So that is a first question, and then I'd like to follow up with a second.
Well, what I'm trying to differentiate in my mind is the peer review committee. The board refers a subset of its cases to the peer review committee, and these are cases where the board usually wants the peer review committee to interview the respondent doctor, to do an in-depth in-person interview, because the board doesn't have time to do that kind of an in-depth personal interview.
Okay.
Because those take a lot of time and effort and file review, and we have a special committee for that. But not all complaints go to the peer review committee, only the ones that are referred by the board, where the board says, we need a personal interview, we need more information, here's a list of questions, please, a second group of chiropractors, look at this. In most cases, when the board refers a case to its peer review committee, a personal interview is conducted before the peer review committee, and then a report is given back to the board. Not in every case, the peer review committee say, we've looked at the files, and we can figure out what's going on without having to bring them in, and they do a file review and write a report and send it back to the board.
So follow up. So is it stated in the guidelines of the peer review committee that there must be a personal interview?
No, there's no specific policy statement. There's a general expectation that when a case goes to the peer review committee, there will be a personal, an in-person interview. And in some cases, we've had to get the board to say to the peer review committee, we really do want an in-person interview for this respondent in this case, so please interview the doctor. In other cases, they've left a little more open-ended, where they just want a second set of eyes on the file, as opposed to necessarily absolutely requiring an interview, and they kind of left it to the peer review to make that call.
So one follow-up, and it's more of a statement, I guess, than a question, but it seems like the opportunity to be able to state your case in person, whether in front of the peer review committee and or the board, seems like something that should be required in my mind, and something I hope that we look at. And the other piece is whether you publicly put something on your board's website about proposed disciplinary action. It just seems like kind of in the face of, you know,
I'm happy to
guilty, innocent until proven guilty.
You know, I think sometimes we forget our mission as a board is public protection, to protect the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of a case currently where I'm wondering if we've done enough notice of the notice of proposed disciplinary action, because, you know, there's a lot of allegations that the doctor hurt a lot of people in the course of his treatment, among a lot of other unprofessional behavior. And for us not to have that fully exposed and available to the public for their knowledge, you know, I'm not sure that we're doing enough sometimes to put that issue out in front in all aspects of our website and our publications, to make sure that people are aware that there's a pending action concerning a doctor. So we're going to talk about that at the board's next meeting, and I'm sure this discussion will factor into that. But if the board determines that there's enough to issue a set of charges and allegations, a notice for both disciplinary action, that's public information. And the question is how public should it be? Should it be a little bit public, mm-hmm. or should it be a lot public? You know, and for serious cases, I'm going to argue for a little more public at the next board meeting because I think the public has a right to know.
But you consider an IME, which is about insurance companies paying for things, the same level of danger to society as a chiropractor in their primary practice having problems? I mean, let's even
Well, the one I'm thinking about doesn't compare to that one.
No.
But it depends.
The answer is no, but I'm not a legislator, so obviously I don't understand all the different rules, but I don't think that we can have two different sets of rules as far as proposed disciplinary action and it being a public document depending on the case of this one is not very dangerous, this one is
You're at the crux of why we asked you here today, because it appeared to me in reading this that you may in fact have two different procedures. One for looking at physicians doing IMEs and one for looking at physicians it looks like I had the impression, and as I say, Mr. McTeague and I have talked on this same case in the past, I have the impression that this was not being treated routinely. And that's a problem. And it's not for us to say whether it was or not. It's for us to say, is there something in the statutes that need to change to assure that you're both protecting the public and protecting the profession, because you have that dual function.
Exactly.
I don't feel that we treated this particular case or one other that we have been called to look at any differently than any other cases that we go through.
I would draw your attention once again to the complaint statistics. This is 3% of our total complaints, three instances of proposed disciplinary action in a 10-year period. It's, you know, when we talk about serious issues that come before the board, we have a lot of other really difficult, serious issues that we're addressing.
So your board member saying this was the most important issue isn't correct, huh?
Well, I think that might have been one opinion at one time and in one report.
It might have been
just... But I'll tell you what the most important issue is. We're dealing with boundary issues. Yeah. That's our number one issue that we're trying to get a handle on. We're trying to get a handle on it for as long as I've been there.
That's the important one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I really do appreciate this. I really wish you would, when you discuss this with the board, talk about this question of how people defend themselves in a way that gives them due process and protects the public. You're absolutely right about this.
We're having a strategic planning meeting in next month's meeting, and we'll make sure it's on the agenda.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry, just one more thing since you're going back and talking about it, so all the thoughts on the table. You know, the you're trying to balance the rights of your members as well as the public, and your response about wanting the public to know if there's proposed disciplinary action. And I just wonder, I don't know how this compares to other licensing boards, but whether you could say what the complaints are, because it seems like in a lot of cases the proposed disciplinary action actually doesn't happen. So there's something that happens between when you put it on and then it gets negotiated or it gets appealed or it gets whatever. And so I just wonder if, in terms of balancing, you can say what a complaint is without saying what a proposed disciplinary action is until you come to a conclusion and give the full due process. So I don't know that you need to respond unless you want it on the record, but just something to think about. It just, and I can't compare it to what other boards do. I'm too new at this, but it's just what comes up as an obvious question.
Very much. I will close the informational hearing and thank you all for coming and bringing this to our attention.
You're welcome.
Bad news for members of the committee. We're going to have to cancel Friday's meeting. I know you all hate that. I mean,
come on.
Why Monday?
But you'll have to come Monday. And we are adjourned.
Can you speak to Carolyn and see if she can cancel?